You're listening to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It might be hard to think about happiness these days, given all that's going on in our country and the world. But Highland Park Rabbi Evan Moffick makes the case that it's the way we understand happiness that's the problem. His latest book is called The Happiness Prayer, Ancient Jewish Wisdom for the Best Way to Live Today. It goes back to ancient Judaic traditions, including one particular prayer that he's used as a spiritual exercise for years. It's part of a happiness curriculum he developed at his temple, Congregation Salal, in Chicago's north suburbs. He's in studio with me here in downtown Chicago, Rabbi Moffick. Welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thanks, Nyla. It's wonderful to see you and to be with you again.
In one sense, I think a lot of people would say there's not much to be happy about these days. I think the last time you were on the 21st, we were talking about refugees being shut out of America.
Yes.
And our moral obligation to bring them in. We're in a country where 1,000 or so neo-Nazis feel comfortable walking on our streets. We just saw and are experiencing what may be the most expensive natural disaster and dozens of deaths in Texas from Harvey. This is a tough time, I think, to be talking about happiness, or at least how we understand it, don't you think?
Tremendously. And I think we look around us and we see so much pain and agony, and it makes us think, what is there to be happy about? But I think that's actually part of the challenge, part of the, it actually, what's happening shows us the need for intentional pursuit of happiness. I mean, one of the things you mentioned, the storm terror in Houston, and one of, I mean, I'm kind of like, you know, a lot of happiness is genetic. We can get into this. You know, about 50% of our general outlook comes from how we're born. So I'm genetically predisposed to be
pretty, you and I are pretty genetically
pretty happy
people.
Which
right.
is great. But that being said, I have seen amazing examples of people with these extraordinary acts of kindness that actually make us happier. You talk to the people who've helped rescue. You talk to the people that have seen people come together to rescue others, and they feel uplifted and inspired, and that's part of the journey to happiness.
Well, and to your point, I think part of this is also an understanding, right? I think there's a very American way that we understand happiness that you think is actually pretty contrary to ancient Judaic traditions of understanding happiness.
Absolutely. I think it's this ancient tradition is countercultural in some ways. We tend to associate, in our consumerist society, we associate happiness with possession. The more things you have, the happier you are. Remember, there's that old bumper sticker, he who dies with the most toys wins, right? So there's this feeling that the more you get, the more status you have, the happier you are. And it's really, I mean, most people understand intuitively that that's wrong, but we have to intentionally pursue a way of life that makes us happier.
And so when you say we have to intentionally do it, you do mean a practice, you do mean an exercise, you do mean this is something we have to think about and develop.
Yes, I think it makes it a lot easier. So look at the word happiness itself. The root is hap, same root as in happenstance. It happened to me. In some ways, it's outside of our control. So this idea of happiness is that it's just something we kind of luck into. But the Jewish idea of happiness, and when I say Jewish, I also mean the biblical idea. I mean, this is part of the way the Old Testament understands it, is that happiness is simcha, which is a Hebrew word meaning joy. It's something we can intentionally pursue. So if we follow these practices in the book, gratitude, acts of kindness, hospitality, then we will be happier in the long run.
So you said 50% of this is genetic.
Yeah.
You start the book by talking about how some people are naturally happy. As we've noted, both of us,
yes.
you and I, are both naturally pretty optimistic people.
Yes.
But you went through a period in your life where you realized, wow, life is really hard for me right now. I'm not sure I can be happy. Can you tell me about that?
Absolutely. I think we all go through that at one point or another. You know, the book of Ecclesiastes says, time and chance befall us all. So I think we all go through difficult experiences. Some go through it very early in life. Some have come from broken families and they see parents having difficulties when they're 3, 4, they begin to experience that. Other people, it comes later. But I do think we all go through, some call it the dark night of the soul, or just difficult circumstances. So to me, it happened when I out of a wonderful achievement. At 30 years old, I became the head rabbi of a wonderful congregation where I still serve in the suburbs of Chicago. And I was just totally overwhelmed. I was a new father and it was not the easiest of pregnancies and deliveries. And we just had so much happening. And then people were turning to me with enormous problems that I didn't feel equipped to handle. And I kind of went into this.
But you're the rabbi, right?
Exactly. I'm supposed to have all the answers.
Adds to the stress, right?
Exactly. I mean, I followed a rabbi who had been there for 25 years. He was 68 years old and he retired, a wonderful, wise, smart person. And then here I am, this 30-year-old, like, yeah, sure, I know the answer. But I didn't. And part of my experience was coming to terms with that, was accepting that, but also trying to draw from the wisdom that I did have and the life experience I did have, and getting, you know, it was a sort of a personal journey to getting in touch with my own emotions and my own sensitivities and needs and desires. And that was it was a great journey. It was a tough journey, but I would do it again. Absolutely.
So part of that journey, you talk about how your father introduced you to Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning.
Yes.
Well, can you explain how and when you first encountered Viktor Frankl and sort of what role that played in all of this?
So it's actually a two-part story. So when I was in college, I remember reading it for a class. But I read it and they said, okay, interesting stuff, meaning, great. But somehow, you know, my dad's a psychiatrist, and he mentioned it to me as I was struggling. I saw that, you know, people, especially in Chicago where you know, you have so many resources, people can go to see therapists for mental health issues. People can go to see, you know, trainers for physical issues. But people turn to clergy for meaning issues. What is my life about? What am I here for? And that's where clergy kind of are the real guides. And then, so the importance of meaning came back to me. That came to say, okay, I need to help guide people to what a meaningful life is. I may not be able to help them understand, you know, addictions. You know, I had people who came to me because their children had serious drug addictions. I may not be able to help them understand where that comes from, but I can help them understand the meaning of their parenthood, of their children's life, and of the journey they're going through.
You mentioned your father being a psychiatrist. I want to ask about the sort of the role of faith and religion in all of this, right? Because there are, and it's very interesting throughout the book, you make an interesting distinction between faith and religion.
Yes.
Why do you make that distinction?
For a couple of reasons. First, I think, first of all, religion often has a negative vibe to it these days, unfortunately. People think religion, people think rules and strictures, and this is what you can't do. And people sometimes associate faith with a positive spin. So I think sometimes we need to clear out that distinction. But I do think every religion is an expression of a deeper faith. But we need those systems. Here's sort of one of the analogies I like to think about. There are hundreds of different kinds of soups, right? They all share a base quality that they're soup, they're liquid, they're hot usually. Well, there's cold soups, but they're usually hot. But then there are different varieties of soups. You can't go into a restaurant and just say, I'd like some soup. You know, maybe they'll bring you broth or something, but usually you'd got, I'll have split pea or I'll have tomato. And that's what makes it meaningful. So I think the same is true with faith. We need particular religions to guide us into a community instead of practices for that faith. But this book and my own, this prayer actually, I think, is universal enough to work with people of different religions.
And I guess my question is would you say, and I think it's interesting in the book, you have a lot of research that talks about how meditation or other prayer, other quote-unquote religious things, right, have been shown to have tangible physical benefits to people's health. Is that part of what I imagine you're trying to anticipate skeptics who are saying, I don't need this.
Absolutely. It's amazing. And this is actually one of the reasons I wrote the book, is a lot of scholars, there's this whole field of positive psychology, which really started out of the University of Pennsylvania, a guy named Martin Seligman, who I have been in touch with. It was beginning to study What makes for a happier life, a life of flourishing, a life of well-being? And they applied rigorous scientific studies to this question. A part of it was psychology had so long focused on what's wrong with people. And Martin Seligman and colleagues said, let's focus on what's right with people, what practices make us happier, not just what, you know, makes us less miserable. So they studied this. And one of their findings was that spirituality, a sense of deeper purpose and reason for being in the universe, was a tremendous predictor of happiness. But they didn't go too far into exploring why, because academia shies away from religion, especially at a place like Penn, a secular university. They didn't want to go too far into it. So there's a lot of exploration that needs to be done, and I felt part of my job was to do that.
I'm speaking with Rabbi Evan Moffick. His latest book is called, it's out next week. The book's called The Happiness Prayer, Ancient Jewish Wisdom for the Best Way to Live Today. And so, Rabbi Moffick, what would you say to people who would say, well, maybe people who are predisposed to religion are people who are predisposed to be happy? Would you say that that's, like in your experience, I'm thinking in particular of your congregation, would you say that's true?
No, I would say, I'd say most people are predisposed to some sort of religion. I'm a believer. There's a guy who wrote a book called The God, DNA, something like that. DNA and God were both in the title. But it talked about how we are in some ways programmed to seek some kind of higher power. So I do think we're
predisposed. The God gene, is that it?
The God gene, that's it. And so I do think we are inclined towards that. So I think religion can appeal to everybody. But I do think that the practices that religion tends to encourage, community, prayer, looking at our life from a higher perspective, those make us happier.
So I want to get into those principles in just a minute, but I want to ask you first how you would define faith.
That's a great question and something I go back and forth. But I think in some ways, faith is self-transcendence, that we are not everything that is in the universe, that everything in the universe can't be defined by genes, by DNA, by chemicals, that there's something bigger than ourselves that we live as part of. And not everything can be seen and understood. You know, I believe faith doesn't ask us to turn off our brains, but I also think what we see, what we can understand and experience in the universe isn't all that there is. My kind of favorite author on this is Abraham Joshua Heschel, who's a great rabbi who talked about radical amazement and wonder, and that wonder is the source of faith, the ability to sort of intuit and imagine that there's more. It's actually in Shakespeare, there's more to life, there's more in heaven and earth than is dreamt of in your philosophy, that there's much more out there than we totally understand.
And you think that's something that we probably tend to lose sight of?
Yeah, I think especially today. I think we live in a world where so much is, you know, driven by information and digits and what we can totally grasp. But I think all of us, I think every person in life goes through moments where they do intuit that there's something bigger than themselves. It could be when they go through a crisis. It could be the birth of a child or a time of healing. I think we all experience that. And then this goes back to a great question you asked earlier, the difference between faith and religion. Faith can be sporadic. It can happen in moments. Religion sort of concretizes those experiences. It gives us a framework for living a life that allows us to, in a sense, put foundations under those experiences. Every person will have these spiritual moments, but religion gives us a structure for experience that transcendence in our daily lives.
That said, why did you or where did you come to developing this happiness curriculum for your temple?
Well, these practices just made sense to me. You know, a lot of the great work in positive psychology has not translated into concrete acts. You know, they know kindness is good, gratitude is good, generosity is good. And one of the beautiful things about religion is that religion, especially Judaism, is about deeds. It's about what you do in your daily lives. So I kind of thought, this can be a bridge between the academic findings of positive psychology and the daily lives of my congregation. And I'm sort of in the trenches, right? Every pulpit, every member of the clergy who is serving a congregation is in the trenches. You are there with people in their darkest moments and their most joyous moments. So I thought, here's in some ways some value I can add in my role as a rabbi and as someone who understands positive psychology.
That's Rabbi Evan Mofik. He's the author of The Happiness Prayer, Ancient Jewish Wisdom for the Best Way to Live Today. When we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with him about this curriculum that he's developed. It's all in this book. It's something that he practices with his congregation, Solal, that's in the Chicago's north suburbs in Highland Park. Stay tuned to this encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in. We're talking about happiness. My guest is Chicago area Rabbi Evan Mofik. His newest book is called The Happiness Prayer, Ancient Jewish Wisdom for the Best Way to Live Today. He's in studio with me here in Chicago talking about this happiness curriculum that he developed. So there's a couple essential ingredients, right?
Yes.
Rabbi Mofik. Let's start, though, with gratitude, because you think that's a key. Why do you feel like we have to start with gratitude in order to develop or cultivate an attitude of happiness?
Well, I think gratitude is a way of focusing the brain. In many ways, the study of positive psychology is, and religion generally, is being upended because of brain science. And what we focus on shapes how we feel, right? We can focus on something positive and we feel better. When we focus on gratitude, when we focus on being thankful for what we have, we are less likely to think about what we don't have. So it really just is a way of focusing the brain. And Martin Seligman did these incredible studies. People who wrote down every day three things they're grateful for. And in fact, I have something, if you order the book, I can send it to you. Just you can send me an email and I will send you a chart that is a way of writing down three things a day that we are grateful for. And if you do that consistently, you will be 40% happier. This happens over 4 weeks, it happens over 8 weeks, it happens over 16 weeks. It's one of the most extraordinary studies. So it refocuses the brain.
Is that something that you do?
Absolutely. I typically do it in the morning. A lot of people do it at night. But I have a whole routine when I wake up in the morning and I write, you know, what am I grateful for from yesterday? And, you know, it helps me recount the day and it also puts me in a positive frame of mind.
Is this something that you do with your kids as well?
I try to. When I put them to sleep, I try. I should be doing it more, but I do think it's important. And we do it especially on the Jewish Sabbath. We talk about what we're grateful for the week. So we do it. We can always do a better job.
But it's interesting, I imagine, when you do this with kids, right? Because you get to sort of learn their personality. You get to learn the things that they're grateful for. And it also, I imagine, helps cultivate a habit in children, too.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there's the thing about gratitude is, in some ways, it's natural, but in other ways, it's not natural. One of the things I uncovered in the research for this book, we see 3,000 advertisements a day, minimal. And this is like cars passing on the road, you know, the ads that come up before YouTubes. People are constantly trying to get us to want things, to cultivate desires. And that's fine. I market things. We all market things. But it's not the route to happiness. You know, it's a route to doing things better, right? We can get more efficient phones and so forth. But if we focus only on what we don't have, we're going to be miserable.
And you were talking about kindness, too. And we were just thinking about tragedies like Hurricane and Tropical Storm Harvey and sort of the acts of kindness that we've seen there. Why do you think that being kind or acts of kindness are really important? Because that's, you know, you said in the Jewish tradition, there is a lot of focus on deeds. Why do you think that is an important thing to do?
That's my favorite chapter of the whole book, is the book on kindness. And that, to me personally, is what I've been working on. See, one of the things I talk about in the book, there are 10 different practices. And unless you're a saint, you're not going to be able to do all 10 all the time.
Right, like visiting the sick in the hospital. There's a whole chapter on how you visit sick people, and that makes us uncomfortable. That's probably not something all of us agree. That's your job to do that.
It's my job, yes. Yes, but we can't do all of them. We have to discern in life moments where we can do more of them, right? If we're raising kids, we're not going to have as much time to honor our own parents. But maybe when we're older and our kids are at home, we have more time. So we have to discern what works for us at these moments in our lives. For me right now, kindness is very important. I think so many of the divisions in our country today can be overcome when we are kind to one another. I don't want it to make it sound like kindness is always easy. It's not. One of the people that I read as I wrote this chapter was a psychologist named Adam Phillips. And he wrote a book about kindness where he talks about we should be more kind. We would be happier. Most people are much happier when they do something kind for another person. Let's say they put coins in a meter for somebody else, or they hold a door open, or just, you know, buy somebody a meal. We feel happier, but we don't do it nearly as much. And part of it is because it exposes us to vulnerability. What if we're rejected? What if that person doesn't appreciate it? So we are not as kind as we could be because it exposes us to feelings. And if we can overcome that and we can be kinder, we'll be happier.
Well, you also talk about how we need to be kind within existing relationships we have, right? It's not just kindness to strangers. You have a long discussion about, you have a great story about a couple at your temple who, were they married for 75 years?
Yes. Oh, incredible couple.
And what was their lesson of kindness?
Well, they had a couple of good ones. They said, you know, one of the ones that the husband said was just say yes, dear, even if you don't understand what she's saying. But
we've heard that. That one we've heard.
Right? Yeah. But part of it was just listening to one another. You know, there's kindness glues couples together. There's a notion that whenever we start a conversation, it's a bid. So let's say somebody says, how was work today? Do you respond, oh, it was interesting, how was your day? Or do you say, ugh, it was terrible, I'm tired, I'm just going to go watch TV? One of them opens up the conversation, the other one closes it off. So opening the conversation leads to healthier relationships.
I'm speaking with Rabbi Evan Moffick. He's the author of a book called The Happiness Prayer, Ancient Jewish Wisdom for the Best Way to Live Today. So I love this idea that you have in the book where you talk about these practices are just also about being open and learning. And I love this idea of experimental innovators. Can you talk about that? Because I think there are people who might be listening thinking you can be open and you can innovate when you're young and that's when all of your creativity happens. But after 30, it's all downhill.
Oh, absolutely not. I think, and sometimes we think that, but I have seen so many people who are older who learn something new and are just tremendous. I was just talking yesterday, I bet she'll be listening later, to a member of my synagogue who was not very active in Jewish life earlier in her career, but she came back to it after she retired and has learned Hebrew, is active, and she is as happy as she can be. I mean, we can, especially if we have decent health, we can continue to grow and do more in older age. And I think as people live longer and are healthier, these are even more important. And we can always work on these qualities. I mean, I'm working on kindness, but still all the time. My wife jokes with me, we'll be in an argument or something, and then someone from the congregation will call on the phone and I'll be like the nicest, sweetest, most kind person in the world. And she's like,
why aren't you doing that to me?
Exactly. So we can always grow and learn in this. And that's the beauty. That's the beauty of religion generally. We don't have to be perfect. God accepts us as we are. And it's a journey to becoming our best selves.
I wonder if you can explain a little bit about when you first encountered the prayer that is the inspiration for this book. Can you tell us about it?
Sure. It's been on my mind for a while. So this prayer is actually taken from the Talmud, which is a textbook of Jewish laws and teachings written, there's 66 volumes, but it's written 2,000 years ago. And this text is recited during a morning worship service. So kind of like in Jewish prayer, there are sections of the Psalms that are recited regularly. And this is a section of the Talmud that's recited regularly. So really, once I started studying positive psychology, it was like a lightning bolt. One morning, I was sitting in services, and the bat mitzvah was chanting this prayer. And I was looking, and I said, wait a minute. Gratitude, lifelong learning, kindness. I'm like, this is all what I've been studying and what I know leads to a happier life. So I just sort of connected the prayer that I had heard hundreds of times. I connected it to what I was studying, and the two came together.
So it's a pretty short prayer, right?
10 verses.
Can you tell us the name and tell us the prayer?
Yeah, it's called the Elu Devarim. And it in Hebrew, it's Elu Devarim She'ein Lehem Shiur, Kibud Av Ve'Eim V'Gimilut Chasadim V'Chach Nasat Beit HaMidrash Shacharit V'Aravit. And it goes on, and there are 10 of them. So it's honor father and mother, acts of loving kindness, diligent pursuit of knowledge and wisdom, hospitality to wayfarers, visiting the sick, celebrating with bride and groom, accompanying the bereaved. And so I list all 10 of these. I translate the Hebrew in a broader way so people can understand the underlying purpose of each of the commandments, but there's 10 of them. The original title for the book was The Other 10 Commandments. My publisher wanted it to be a little more open. You know, sometimes the word commandments can throw people off, but I love that title.
You like The Other 10 Commandments. That's better than the notion of this prayer, which has become sort of a discipline, right?
Yes.
So it's an interesting notion, though, I think, that people tend to think. So that's a really interesting kind of marketing question, right? So the Other 10 Commandments gets to, I think, a lot of the ideas that religion and faith are rules that you have to follow.
Right.
I guess, but there is part of this where you're saying that it's this structure is something, making having an exercise, having it be a habit.
Yes.
There's a reason why spiritual exercises have the word exercise in it, right?
Yes. Spiritual practices or exercises, and that it's ongoing. And in many ways, you know, I'm a person of faith. I'm a rabbi. So I do believe there are commandments that come from God. But not all people believe that. But I still think these practices are good for them. These practices work whether you believe they come from a commander or not. And that's partially why.
Or what faith tradition you come from.
Exactly. Exactly. It works. There was a famous scientist named Pasteur who said, you know, I'm going to err on the side of faith. I don't know one or the other. But these work. It's kind of like, and this is a very Jewish thing in a way. In some ways, it doesn't always matter what you believe. It matters what you do. And these practices, whether you believe they come from God or whether you believe they're mandated by your religious tradition, they work in helping us live a happier life. So that's why the book is framed in the way it is. Because I want people who aren't even religious at all, who they're looking to say, a rabbi, but even if they're not religious, they'll find this helpful. And nobody has really explored the depth of the relationship between spirituality and happiness. And I think there's a whole new field to explore, and I hope that people can begin to embrace it. And that religion, my ultimate goal is that religion and faith can be a source of good and joy for people rather than a source of division.
One of the important things we haven't really talked about, and we've kind of touched on it, is community. And I wanted to just ask you about what you think the role of community is in all of this. Because we've talked about our individuality in terms of our individual spirituality, in terms of individual choices that we make, whether we're choosing to be kind to people, cultivating that. But what role does relationship and community play in this?
Huge. And that's another one of the great advantages of religious communities. You know, there was a study done a couple years ago that said people who belong to a church or a synagogue, and I presume a mosque would fit as well, they live 7 years longer on average than people who don't. And I think one of the reasons for that is other people are looking out for them, and they have connections with other people. Social connections make us happier and healthier. And you don't have to be friends with everybody in the world, but we need a sort of core group of people.
Yeah, you have actually a number. You have like 8 to 10,
yes,
right? You call them the 2 a.m. people?
The 2 a.m. people.
And what is that? And that means?
These are the people who you could call at 2 a.m. and they'd answer the phone and be there for you, regardless of that it's 2 a.m. in the morning. And, you know, the truth is most of us don't have 8 or 10 of those outside of our family or a spouse or whatever. Most of us don't, especially men. You know, there's an interesting study that men generally have fewer of those than women, but we need them. And we need to be, I mean, I know this about myself, you know. I mean, I'm a rabbi, so I have a lot of great acquaintances. But, you know, these friendships of people who don't care what you do, they don't care what you do for them. They simply love you and cherish you for who you are. We need to be intentional in finding those kind of people.
I wanted to think about this. I'm thinking about the fact you write about this in the book that you preside over a lot of funerals.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder what perspective that gives you. And you talk about this also, sort of a Jewish tradition of remembering the day someone died as
yes.
opposed to the day that they were born.
Yes, because a birth is a potential. But when somebody passes away, you can look at their life as a whole. And there's something we can honor in a person who has lived life fully. And by living life fully, that doesn't mean you achieved everything you want to achieve or you were rich or successful or famous. It means you had meaningful relationships. And I see that over and over again. I mean, these funerals that I do, in some ways, are the best tutorials on how to live. I mean, I think about that all the time. It's the most important thing that I do because it really shows what matters in the end. And what ultimately matters are the relationships that we have and the ways we've touched other people's lives.
And so I imagine it must be hard for you for funerals where maybe a lot of people don't show up.
Yes, that's true. I mean, I see that. I mean, the sad truth is, especially people who live a long time. I mean, I just officiated a funeral for an amazing, wonderful woman. She was 97 years old. So most of her friends had died already. So there weren't that many people, but this was a person who was just magnificent. So in some ways, if you live a very long life, it's harder to have a lot of people who come. But the truth is, it's the people who you touched and your children and grandchildren, the memories that they share, and the simple things. I mean, this may sound cliche-ish, but it's really true. Were you available for them? Were you around? Did you create happy memories? The memories could be as simple as, you know, playing catch or going for a walk, but those make a huge difference.
So I want to just end by asking, you write that all of life is a quest to return to the ancient wisdom we once knew by heart.
Well, that's a beautiful Jewish midrash. So midrash is Jewish interpretation of the biblical text. It's answering questions that are posed. And the midrash actually comes from, why do we have our Adam's apple? And so the rabbis asked this question, and they said, it's because right before we were born, all the wisdom, the Torah, that we had learned was plucked from us. Isn't that? It's a wonderful. But they were so. They
only
were,
men have yeah. an Adam's apple.
Well, that's
right?
true. Well, yeah, that's okay. What? Okay. So the biblical.
The men had the wisdom plucked from them.
Yes.
I'd like to
women
that
still have that. Women okay. still have it. But the idea is, I think the deeper truth behind this is that much of our faith traditions, it's uncovering what we already know and what we're blocked from experiencing in life. You know, we know that love matters. We know that kindness it makes us happier. We know that community, you know, builds deeper relationships that we need, but we're pulled in so many different directions. So life is a journey to recovering that wisdom that we once had. It's built into us, but we have to get back to it. You know, T.S. Eliot has that great poem where he talks about to return to where we came from and to know that place for the first time. And I think that's kind of what the journey of Torah and learning and really the journey of happiness is. Because I think all of us, if you read this book, I'm not introducing any revolutionary new theory. In a way, I'm reminding people of what we already know and giving examples and insights on how to live in that way.
His book is called The Happiness Prayer, Ancient Jewish Wisdom for the Best Way to Live Today by Rabbi Evan Moffick. Thanks for being with me, Rabbi.
Thanks, Nyla. It's an honor and a joy to talk with you.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. Richard and Mildred Loving just wanted a regular married life when they fell in love more than 50 years ago. But Richard was white, Mildred was black, and interracial marriage was illegal in the state of Virginia where they live. So they traveled to Washington, D.C. to tie the knot. And when they moved back to Virginia, local authorities arrested them. That was the start of a case that went all the way to the Supreme Court. 50 years ago, the High Court's ruling of Loving versus Virginia struck down state laws that criminalized interracial marriage. I'm joined now by our studios here in downtown Chicago at the Medill Graduate School of Journalism, Northwestern University, by Destiny Perry. She's an assistant professor also at Northwestern University at its Pritzker School of Law. Destiny, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me. I appreciate
it. Thanks for having me.
I briefly mentioned Richard and Mildred Loving in their case. I think lots of people maybe have seen the documentary that came out this year about it. For people who haven't, what else can you tell us about their story?
I think it's important to emphasize that they really were just a regular couple. A lot of big cases that end up at the Supreme Court, even landmark cases, don't start off as cases where
they're just normal people, right?
Right. They just think,
especially 50 years ago.
Exactly. They just think, we want to be married. We want to be lawfully married. We want our relationship to be legitimate in our home state, in the state that we love. And so when they started this process, they were really just trying to deal with wanting to be able to live in the state of Virginia, their home state, as a married couple. It was only after the Civil Rights Act of 1964, when Mildred Loving wrote to Attorney General Robert Kennedy at the time and said, is there anything you can do for us? She wasn't thinking about necessarily that this could change the landscape of laws in the entire country.
And not just laws, right? Because
exactly.
As we look at before we get to the societal part, let me ask you a law question.
Sure.
What were the laws around interracial marriage during that time? Was it something that was just illegal in the South, or was this true across much of the United States?
So at the time that Loving was decided in 1967, there were 16 or 17 states, mostly or all southern states, that still had prohibitions against interracial marriage, including statutes that criminalized, meaning that people could go to jail for interracial marriage. In Virginia, they also had a statute against going to a state where it was legal to get married and coming back to Virginia. So 16 or 17 states at the time it was decided. There had been more states prior to that, but the civil rights movement had done some work to get rid of some of those statutes in other states.
And what did it mean that interracial marriage, it was a criminal, it wasn't a civil offense?
Right. And so criminal meant that they could be brought into court, and if
they could go to jail.
They could go to jail. And if you look at the legal history of these, they were called anti-miscegenation laws. If you look at the history of these laws, there was a continued ramping up over time of the punishments afforded to anyone who was found guilty of violating these racial integrity acts. That was the name of the act in Virginia at the time, that were meant to bar these cross-racial relationships. So they started with smaller prison time or fines, and they eventually worked themselves up. The states worked themselves up to longer and longer prison sentences and increased fines.
So when this first case came up to lawyers in Virginia, was it immediately obvious to them that this could be a landmark case? It's always interesting to look back in hindsight, right?
I think so. I don't know the kind of full detailed history here, but basically after Mildred wrote to Attorney General Kennedy, he forwarded it to the American Civil Liberties Union, who forwarded it to affiliates that they had in Virginia. And seemingly those affiliates of the ACLU realized that there was something about this case that could make it a landmark case. But at the very initial stages of the Loving story, again, they were just trying to not be imprisoned for wanting to be married in the state of Virginia.
A white person and a black person who wanted to be married to each other. As is the case with a lot of Supreme Court cases, Destiny, the ruling isn't the end of the story, right? Because how did states respond to this ruling when it first came down?
As we saw in the civil rights movement and with other cases, including the desegregation case Brown v. Board of Education, states did not immediately comply. And in fact, there were states that were resistant. And just like we saw very recently after the same-sex marriage case, it is guaranteed that there were local county clerks who issued marriage licenses that, despite the Supreme Court ruling, would refuse to issue marriage licenses. In fact, I think not that long ago, a few years ago, we had a county clerk who refused to issue a marriage license to, I can't remember the details of that story, but someone who was white and a white black couple, you know, in the 2000s, just a few years ago. And that's the difficulty with the Supreme Court decision, but there's a bunch of local officials who are the ones who have to enforce and adhere to the law. And only if you kind of get a lawsuit or something like that, can you make sure that the law is always being enforced?
Well, it's a really interesting question. And as a law professor, I'm curious your thoughts on the idea of legal precedent changing cultural attitudes, because that's precisely what you're talking about, right? The fact that this set a legal precedent, but obviously went against, for a lot of people, the prevailing cultural attitudes at the time.
And this is a big debate, actually, in law, at legal scholarship, in legal practice, about whether law leads the way in terms of changing social attitudes or whether social attitudes change and the law follows. Certainly in the civil rights movement, the law seemed to be leading the way and doing things ahead of people, society being ready to do it. And even after Loving, there was a fairly quick increase in the number of people who sought marriage licenses for their interracial relationships. And we've certainly seen over time, over decades now, a fairly large explosion in the number of couples who are interracial married couples.
And I wanted to ask you about that in a minute, because I know you've done research on psychological research on the perception, particularly of mixed race children in the U.S. Before we get to that, I'm just sort of curious what your parallels are as someone who, from an academic perspective, of the interracial marriage issue, and as you mentioned, the same-sex ruling that we've seen in America in the past couple of years, also with Supreme Court, with DOMA. Do you see that as is that a pretty equitable parallel? You're shaking your head yes.
Yes, yes. And it's certainly, if you read the opinions in the cases leading up to the same-sex marriage cases, so the cases that were handled by the appellate level, the different circuits across the U.S., and then eventually the Supreme Court, Loving played an incredibly important role in providing the precedent for the arguments that the Supreme Court ultimately decided Obergefell on. So Loving set the precedent for this argument, these arguments about equal protection, about the right to marry, and not kind of discriminating against people for wanting to marry other humans. This isn't a matter of kind of deviant or what most people these days consider deviant behavior. These are just people who love each other who want to get married, and states are interfering with that.
And so do you feel like, I wonder, culturally, it sounds like though we were at a different point with same-sex marriage now than, you're also nodding your head yes, than it was. The Loving versus Virginia case was clearly a point where this was very taboo.
Yes. And the same-sex marriage, the development of those attitudes over time have been very accelerated compared to attitudes around race. So the public opinion around same-sex marriage has changed fairly rapidly.
It's changed very quickly. Right. Oh, so interesting. So from your perspective, do you think that's just a cultural thing as opposed to illegal?
It's hard to say. And this is why it remains a debate and has always been a debate, the extent to which the law is influencing or reflecting what's going on. And I think it's probably a little bit of both, that for sometimes judges, the Supreme Court, et cetera, are responding to attitudes they see out there. And at the same time, they're also influencing people.
You've done a lot of psychological research on the perception of mixed race children in America, which obviously has a lot to do with how mixed race couples are seen. And I wonder how much does that play also into changing cultural attitudes of mixed race couples when we look at also the numbers of mixed race children, multiracial, biracial children in the U.S.
So interestingly, in the Loving case, one of the arguments made by Virginia was that there was concern about the children that would be produced. And Mildred and Richard had three children, that they would be, you know, and this is a kind of common story out there about mixed race kids, that they, you know, will be confused, that they won't fit in anywhere. We don't know how to categorize them, et cetera. And my research on the social psychology side of things shows people know perfectly well a lot of times how to categorize these folks. We have long histories of just categorizing them, especially as non-white in the U.S. But there is a lot of concern about, or and has traditionally been a lot of concern about how these children who result from these interracial relationships will be able to negotiate their identities.
But it's interesting you say that, because I think while certainly there is that conversation about that, I have to think about my family, so much of my family is also mixed race. And the sort of the cultural comments about, you know, how beautiful they are because they reflect, you know, Indian and all of these, you know, other. So it's an interesting conversation. Yeah. Now I feel like that is also part of our.
So on the other side of that, there's a theory that's called hybrid vigor, which is about basically how the argument, the positive argument for mixed race kids, which is, you know, that they kind of get the best of both worlds. They're more beautiful. They have the best and the worst, I guess, would probably be how you would sum it up nowadays. Basically, that there is this argument that they are more beautiful. They are all, you know, they are lighter skinned. They're all of these things than a lot of times the minority groups that they come from. But there's still this kind of tragic mulatto story that exists there, too, that assumes that they're confused and they don't know, you know, where they fit in and things like that. So there is a kind of duality to being a mixed race person and how people view you, both in positive and negative light.
Yeah. So I guess you would say 50 years on, where do you think we're at now?
Well, there is a lot of discussion about how interracial marriage is increasing. So it's something like 16-17% of marriages now are interracial, according to a recent Pew report. And as you mentioned, the population changes, demographic changes. There's more and more mixed race children all of the time. And lots of people think this will solve our racial problems. I'm not in that camp. I don't think it will solve our racial problems. So there is this kind of hopeful narrative out there about how increasing interracial marriage and more multiracial children will fix our problems, but it certainly is much more complicated than that.
It's obviously much more complicated than that. We could spend a whole hour talking about that. You'll have to come back and we'll have to do that conversation. But I really want to thank Destiny Perry. She's an assistant professor at Northwestern University's Pritzker School of Law, for us just having a little moment here to remember what happened 50 years ago, landmark Supreme Court ruling of Loving versus Virginia. Destiny, thank you so much for being with
Thanks
me. I appreciate
for having
it.
Me.
One last topic for us today. This is a big month to be on the watch out for deer on the road. And last year, nearly 4 in 10 of all deer collisions in Illinois happened in October, November, and December. November being the most dangerous month. As we begin this month, we wanted to take a minute to talk about advice to stay safe on the roads. Last year, there were more than 14,000 vehicle accidents involving deer in the state of Illinois. Joining us right now is Paul Shelton. He's a wildlife biologist with the Illinois Department of Natural Resources. Hey, Paul, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
We just have about a minute or two left, Paul. I wonder if you could just quickly give us a tip or two for folks. I think the most important thing maybe is common sense tips. If you're about to hit a deer, what should you do?
Well, swerving is not the thing you want to do. First of all, be aware. You know, I think a lot of people don't think about deer until they actually see one. But, you know, particularly this time of year, be aware of where you've seen them in the past, because deer accidents are not random. And so in those areas where you've seen deer before, be particularly aware and be on the watch for them. Never assume that a single deer is crossing the road. Be looking for another one behind it. And don't swerve. It's much less dangerous to hit a deer than it is to hit a tree or a bridge abutment.
So it goes against instinct, right? You're basically saying if you see a deer, don't swerve to avoid it. Go straight into the deer.
Yeah, your brake, you know, being wary and being ready to brake, those are the two number one things that you should be doing. Slow down as much as possible, but don't swerve into oncoming traffic. Maintain control of your vehicle. That's critical.
Right. Okay. Well, Paul, I appreciate those tips. It's a good advice for us also just to remember, especially as people are distracted driving anyway, to be even more careful. You shouldn't have your phone out anyway, but especially this time of year, right, Paul, when we're thinking about deer on the roads. Of course, I guess I remember also, right, dawn and dusk, kind of the most common times to be careful about looking out.
Yes, deer are what we call crepuscular. They're very active in the early morning hours and in the times around sunset. And that's kind of exacerbates the situation, because this time of year, lots of people are commuting back and forth to work at those peak times of their movements.
Right. So everyone needs to remember to be careful during that time. Thank you so much for those tips for us. Paul Shelton is a wildlife biologist with DNR with the state of Illinois. Paul, thank you for being with us. That does it for us today. I'm Nyla Boodoo, broadcasting from Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism in downtown Chicago. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.